morning, everybody.
Hello. It's everybody's favorite day.
It's Fascism Friday.
Fascism Friday.
Although in TGIF, if you go to those Fridays restaurant chains, it's always Fascism Friday. Millennials won't get that because they don't have fast food like restaurant chains anymore. They killed them all, along with Diamonds and all the other industries, Applebee's. So for the millennials watching, which I know maybe a lot, like there used to be restaurants that you go to any city and they were the same. And one of those was Friday.
I've seen all those places still. They still exist.
Really? I thought the millennials killed them all.
Yeah, that was a rumor.
Okay, well, all that. They're like, no, thank you. I'd rather stay home and eat avocado toast. And squander my vast wealth paying off student debt that I'll never get out from under. Anyways.
Oh my God.
It is Fascism Friday. And just to introduce ourselves, I'm Mark Van Steenwyck. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing. And today,
part three.
Hope
amidst vast.
Fastarkery.
You know, Fastarkery.
Something. Fastarkery.
Forkery, as Catherine Parent suggested.
Right. Or fluffery.
Fluffery. So the general gist of this week has been like, hey, you guys talk about some heavy stuff. What about hope? What's the positive angle on this? And so we're responding to that by saying, well, there is hope, and it's part of the driving force of the spiritual life. It's the posture that you take amidst all this, the vast fuckery, is kind of orientation towards the spiritual life, but not in some sort of love and rainbows kind of sense, but in a way that is unflinchingly engaging in the challenges of the world because of deep compassion and presence. Like, that's kind of maybe my little nutshell version of what we're going for this week.
That was an outstanding summary.
Thank you. You know, I think about it a lot, and it is almost as much as I think about fascism and how I want to destroy it.
That's right.
Bash the fash.
But don't belong to an organization called Antifa, which doesn't exist.
I was a part of it for a while. I was an undersecretary of the Northwest chapter of Minneapolis for a time.
I always wondered, undersecretary, it's like, what are you under?
A secretary, I guess.
Yeah.
It could be a type of desk or a person, I guess.
Right. Some strange sex position.
Well, we're just meandering all over the place.
So one of the things, just before we get too far, I just want to mention that on the transmission page version of the announcement about today, I've put a link to another video cast, which is much longer than ours. It's about twice as long as ours. That really touches on actually a lot of the same topics that we've been talking about this week and kind of in general, only specifically related to the issue of Black politics. And it's with a guy named Adolph Reed Jr. is the guest. And for those that haven't heard of him or read his stuff, he's really very radical Black activist, writer, academician. He's gotten a lot of crap from a lot of people for basically calling out a lot of performative race politics. Was never a big fan of like Barack Obama, things like that. And
probably very anti-neoliberal in that.
Yeah, very anti-neoliberal. And really sees things in a very, through a very class analysis. And so, you know, so their video cast is at least as negative as ours. So I feel less alone. Nice. But it's really good. So I very much encourage you to take a look at it. And one of the ways that when we were talking before we started that I wanted to kind of kick this kick this day off with is, you know, when we're connecting this theme for this week and anti-fascism and, you know, the spiritual life, is that one of the things about the spiritual life is that as we practice it and as we engage in a community, we have the experience of a great sense of compassion arising. And compassion is fundamentally anti-fascist.
It is.
Yeah. You know, and oftentimes we'll see some horrible thing happen. You know, so one of the things, obviously, we're in the midst of the Derek Chauvin trial, so we think about what he did to George Floyd. You know, or I remember a couple months ago, we talked about, you know, these police in Portland that, like, guarding a dumpster so people wouldn't get food out of a dumpster. You know, you see things that, and you think, like, how could somebody do that? Right. And I think I mentioned before, there's this great book that looks at this one Nazi army unit that really gets at this question of, you know, how could these people end up doing the things that they did? Right. Mm-hmm. And basically, in order to do these things, you have to cut off your compassion and your humanity. Right. That's one of the things you have to do, because, you know, if you see, I mean, it's very natural. If you see a hungry person and there's a big pile of food, you're like, here, have some food. Like, that's the natural compassionate response, you know, and in order to stand between that hungry person, and the food with weapons and say, you cannot have this food or I will, you know, arrest you or beat you up or whatever. You have to cut off that compassion.
Yeah, and just to kind of springboard a little bit, like, just a couple of comments. I get Wiley writes, this title alone is worth the price of admission. So much fuckery, indeed. And then yes. Ed says, compassion is anti-fascist. Love that idea. And I want to unpack that compassion is anti-fascist thing a little bit and tie it into the negativity thing. So why is it, I have this fundamental assumption that human beings at their most healthiest are compassionate. And yeah. One of the reasons, not a, like there's other stuff in there. Like, obviously I'm not a pure being of compassion. I'm not the Buddha, right? There's other sorts of stuff, but a lot of that stuff in there that keeps me from compassion is part of my like malformation.
Right.
And part of how our society is malformed to these systems that we believe to be normative. So what happens is, someone who might otherwise be compassionate, maybe is compassionate to people that they have affinity towards, right? Other white people or other men, whatever, sees this dumpster situation and think, well, you know, there's laws. People shouldn't be going to dumpsters. There's liability issues. And they start building the case based upon structural assumptions. Right. As Hannah Arendt would, like, the banality of evil, like cliched thinking, like this is just the way it is. And if someone's breaking the rules, I mean, people were protesting. So when that car ran into them, it's their own fault for blocking the interstate. Like this sort of way of thinking, like somehow now structures like interstates and motor vehicle laws trump humanity. And so that's what we have happening. This is what hierarchy does and bureaucratic systems do. Is they create this buffered reality or these structures that distort our perception and make it harder for us to be present with one another in a real and deep way. And spiritual practice at its best tries to cut through that. So in a way, deep spirituality, compassion, is very anarchistic because it just says, well, I see that there's these systems in place and there's hierarchy. But that's getting in the way of humanity. So I choose humanity. Screw that stuff. Right. Someone comes along and you're like, your whole orientation is cutting through the stuff so that you can be present to people, present to the land, present to God, whatever. But they don't have the same analysis. So they look at it as like, wait, you're tearing stuff down. Why are you being so negative?
Right. Yes.
And yes. My response is, why are you? You're privileging these systems that you can't even see over people. Why are you being so negative? Would be my response. Now, obviously, I'm also negative. Like, I can be overly gloomy about stuff. So that's guilty as charged. I can be that way. I experience depression. It's real, and I'd rather not be so gloomy sometimes. Yeah. But this fundamental orientation is often called out.
It's fundamentally it's one of the reasons then that incremental change is often held up by people as being really great, which, you know, sometimes it is great. On the other hand, when you talk about much more radical systemic change, one gets accused of being negative, right, or unrealistic. And that is that exactly that knee-jerk reaction that you're talking about, is that if we're privileging the systems, and we're saying, well, fundamentally, the systems are, you know, the best. And sure, so let's tweak the systems to make them better. But we have to keep them, right? So when we talk about, what might a different world be? And this was the other thing we were talking about before we got started, that imagination is actually a form of prayer. How could we imagine a completely different system where human beings were privileged, right? Suddenly that sounds like some sort of impossible thing that we shouldn't even talk about.
Naive utopian visions.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, some comments coming in, like some Ed saying, you're not, how do you know? Just so you know, like, we don't get these in order. Like, comments come in from various sources in the order that they're stated, rather than in sort of subthread. So we often don't know the context. So if you're commenting, the more context you can give, the better. And also be reminded that a long comment is likely to get cut off based upon our platform. So Ed, I'm not sure what you're referring to, Ed. So if you could flesh it
out. Well, I think he's referring to you saying that you're not Buddha. And he's asking you, you're not?
If that's the case, you know, the whole nice thing about Buddhism is that we're all supposed to go for that. Like, he's not some sort of different class of being.
Well, of Buddhism. It just popped up, the Buddha.
So yeah.
I was right.
You know, that's a good question. It's also like, am I not, like, since I am part of the body of Christ, am I not in some deep way Christ? This gets really deep. But yes. Yes and no. Am I the Buddha? Yes and no. Wiley says, Buddha would say, we could do a lot on teaching about Buddhism and Christianity and how they interplay with each other sometime. That'd be a fun one.
Yeah.
But Wiley says, Buddha would say that compassion is the height of human evolution. Maybe. I mean, I don't think that idea is discordant with Buddhism. I don't know if Buddhists would say that explicitly, but I like that idea. CK writes, yes, compassion must smash systems of brutality. I mean, this is the tension, like, because we're conditioned to think of compassion, which already is not a nice term. It means to suffer with, okay? It's not a rosy term. It's not, oh, I feel bad. It's like, oh, you're suffering. I'm in there with you. Like, and I feel the visceral pain of that. And I might even feel the lash, right? And so the idea that we tie compassion with only gentle things or politeness is really this amazing con job. Because you're right.
Yeah.
Compassion smashes the fesh. Jim writes, amazing how clubby American politicized evangelicalism really is. It is. I'm trying to connect that with within evangelicalism, there's a compassion towards certain people who are deserving. One of the ways that evangelicalism, other religious groups like this too, is that it creates a categories of deserving versus undeserving, which is a type of hierarchy, which tends towards fascism. So there you go.
Yeah. So, Kathleen's comment is a great one relative to what we were just talking about. Yeah. Go ahead, read it.
Kathleen writes, a lot of preachers slam John Lennon for his song Imagine, where he imagined a world without religion, countries, or possessions. Seems like a good vision to me.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Kathleen, that's a great example. I mean, I don't remember when that song came out, but it was a long time ago. So it's been around for a while. And, I have always found it absolutely hilarious how many negative comments I've heard about that song. Right. Basically, you know, for those of you that have never heard that song, go listen to it. You know, to present this vision where, again, human beings and humanity and love and caring is privileged, and for people to say how terrible the song is, or unrealistic, or stupid, or scary, is an absolutely perfect example of the phenomenon that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Right? That people and their, because remember, these systemic structures aren't just external, they're also internal. Mm-hmm. Right? So they have formed us. These structures are in our heads, right? Yeah. Capitalism is in our heads. Fascism is in our heads. You know, white privilege is in our heads. Whiteness and all these kinds of things are in our heads. And we are addicted to these structures because they're the things we've used to form reality. And so it's how we navigate the world.
Even if we think those things are all crappy.
Right.
So white, we have different perspectives on this, but white supremacy infects each of us differently. We're all infected by it. So even if you're someone who is on the under the heel of white supremacy, there can be ways that you're addicted to it, because not because you're a bad person, but because you've been habituated to live in reality structured by white supremacy, and it's hard to instinctively imagine alternatives.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like yesterday, Vanderbilt Divinity School had this great live discussion about Asian Pacific Islander racism in America, and they had this great panel, all these folks. And, you know, that was one of the things that the guy that started off was talking about. He was saying, so, you know, the white gaze, right, how white people and white society see everyone has formed the way everyone sees each other. Right. So he was talking about specifically, you know, some people talk about, well, you know, what's the relationship between Asian people and Black people in America? Where's that? Where are those issues, the negativity, some of the things come from? And he said, well, look, the way white people see these people informs their view of each other. Right? So it's a perfect example of what you were just talking about, that internal formation. So when a Black person, an Asian person are looking at each other, even when there are no white people around, whiteness has formed that relationship, right? So yeah, so these structures are internalized and we hold on to them, we're addicted to them. And so, yeah, so even when somebody comes along with a song that says, imagine no countries, right? Which of course from space, you can't see any countries. There are no countries on the planet. There are no countries. That's a construct. There's land, there's water, there's air, there's the basic elements. And somebody says, imagine no countries, and people freak out. Like, oh my God, you're some kind of, you know, communist psycho, you know, dangerous person. Well, what's dangerous is that you're threatening these privileged systems.
Maria writes, it's very rare that change doesn't come incrementally. That'd be another thing to talk about, like the relationship between different kinds of incremental changes and different sorts of more revolutionary activities and how they play off of each other. So like even talking about slavery in America, like you could say that you could look at that from an incrementalist perspective, and then you can take a step back and look at Harper's Ferry and the Civil War, and like, well, those weren't very incremental. So anyone who wants to put everything in the revolutionary bucket is like, well, that writes off too much of the incremental stuff. And there's different kinds of incrementalism, and there's the kind of incrementalism, appeal to incrementalism, that actually obscures the fact that we're not moving the ball forward. So it's messy.
Yeah. I mean, we could do a whole week on the topic of change. I think, Maria, what you're expressing is definitely the dominant view. There are a lot of people that actually think very differently about change, actually, non-incremental change is much more common than we want to think, and that radical shifts are not only very possible, but actually happen all the time big ways and small ways. And there's all kinds of really interesting work and theory about that, and psychology and mathematics and physics, all kinds of stuff. We spent all week on that.
Even talking about evolution, like it's actually a discussion within evolutionary biology.
Oh, yeah, right.
So, I mean, I think it's worth talking about. And so I'm glad you raised that. Like, well, how do we understand this? And how does, practically, what does it mean about how we posture ourselves? Good question. Good comment. Kathleen, we already got that one. Catherine writes, I once refused to sing Imagine at a hippie Puget Sound fellowship. I used to hate that too, because it's like, imagine there's no heaven. I'm like, you're going, that's a bridge too far.
No religions. Yeah.
But I mean, that's part of the point though, too. Like, even if you're going to be super duper Orthodox Christian about it, lowercase o, the goal is that there's not a heaven, because it's all supposed to come here on earth. And the bridge between whatever we think of as the God realm and our realm is supposed to be demolished so that God is ever present here. And we don't even need the sun anymore because of the radiance of God is present. So even that vision is a heavenless vision. So I'll blow your mind a little bit.
That's pretty radical.
CK writes, it seems that the natural progression to all the brutality is that we, the people, no longer let cops brutalize us. We cannot stand by and let them kill with impunity. Amen. Yeah. Maria writes, I've been stuck in the middle of being accountable to systems and certain expectations and caring for people. There are so many fears that I have had to deal with. The more I have become aware of those fears, the better I've been able to make choices.
Ah, yes. That's awesome. So that's one of the things that we were this week in the Howard Thurman class I was doing, which just wrapped up this week. We were talking about this topic of freedom, which was something that Thurman wrote a lot about, and is a big topic within all contemplative teachings and mystical teachings. And and we're reading one of his essays from the 60s, in which he talked about the fact that one of the most important things about the civil rights movement is that large numbers of Black people started to lose their fear, and that created this climate of freedom within these mass movements. And so it's exactly what you're talking about, is that our fears, which are one of the techniques that these internalized structures use to keep us trapped in them, right? So we're afraid, like if there's no religion, oh my God, then we'll all be like having sex with animals and, you know, doing all these weird things. Yeah, that's what you hear all the time. Like, if we get rid of Christian morals, you know, everybody will be eating babies and it'll just be, you know.
I mean, right? There's been so many times I've walked up to a baby and be like, I want to eat that, but I'm afraid of eternal punishment.
Right.
That's
been the thin line.
The thin line has been my devotion to Jesus and fear of hell. It's the only reason I haven't consumed copious amounts of baby.
So when we get rid of those fears, when those fears start to evaporate, which is another thing that our spiritual practice does for us, then we enter into a place of freedom where we can make real choices.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wiley says that whiteness is the default setting. That's kind of the insidious nature of it. That's why so many of us white folks can walk around and be like, what? Why are you so upset?
You know, and I was even talking about this with somebody the other day in terms of fiction related to time travel, right? And how, so Octavia Butler, one of her books, and if for folks who are not Octavia Butler fans, go out there and become them. She's incredible.
They're adapting some of her stuff for streaming services, so that'll be an opportunity for people who aren't really writers.
Yeah. So I haven't recommended a book for a while. Here you go,
Kindred.
Classic. So this is a time travel book where this young Black woman finds herself whisked off to the antebellum South. And she's a slave suddenly, right? And it's, you know, it's terrifying. And the whole thing is a nightmare. And I was talking with somebody about the fact about how so much time travel fiction, without people realizing it or talking about it, is actually the default setting of whiteness, right? It's this idea of like, hey, I can go back in time. It'll be cool. It'll be fun, you know? Yeah, maybe I'll have these wild adventures. Like, I'll get to fit in with society. And, you know, for people of color, like, time travel, not a really interesting idea to most times and places, right? Within the last 500 years. And so even there, right? Even there, even in this genre of fiction, whiteness is the default setting.
That reminds me, there's a Louis C.K. skit, and he's kind of a, turned out to be a scumbag, but he talks about how time travel, and like, if you're white, you can time travel back, and everyone's like, oh, there's a table right here for you, sir. But how he doesn't want to time travel forward. Because what if, it's like, if there's social justice in the future, I'm afraid. Because then I might, that might be bad for me. So time travel is always great for white people, but you don't want to travel forward. Like, that's kind of the skit. And then it's one of these acerbic ways of like exploring this idea that I, makes me sad that I don't really watch Louis C.K. anymore because he's a scumbag. Catherine writes, okay, so I wondered if there was a glove slippage. Catherine does cleaning stuff during the day, and there's often slippery glove situations. So, oops, glove slipped at a hippie environmentalist camp for troubled teens because it was atheistic, which makes me think, what does hope look like when we allow ourselves to put hope in oft-forbidden things other than the hope equals Jesus and Jesus equals only certain theologies about Jesus' mindset. Yes. I mean, that's a great question. Can we have hope without it being tied up with some sort of eschatological Jesus-y vision of divine retribution? And I mean, I have some hope in that, but honestly, the further along I go, the less my hope is in that sort of thing and more it is in the spirit at work if we're attentive to one another.
Right.
Which can be atheistic looking,
Well, yeah, or just different, right? I mean, and so, you know, when we talk about these structures that are in our heads, right, our view of God is one of those structures. And so, right, what happens when we, you know, blow up that structure as well? You know, we've talked about that a lot here, Catherine. You've had a lot of great insights and comments about that. I mean, so, you know, and that is both from contemplative teachings in general, but certainly a huge focus of Buddhist contemplative teachings, right? That everything is projection. And so, you know, what is beyond all of that? And again, I think that when people start applying that to socio-political things, all that rises is some sort of, you know, terror. Just like, well, what's beyond all of that is disaster. Right? As if, you know, it's not possible to create some kind of society that centers human beings.
As comments go along those lines, inequality, division, racism, property, etc., exist in our heads. Mysticism should free or relativize these concepts. We should connect with ultimate reality or heaven, where these concepts don't exist. God is all in all. Yeah. I mean, that's to me the idea of like, you'd think if someone who leans towards an authoritarian view of God, that they privilege a divine perspective on things. You know, and so Jesus' teachings is all about that kind of thing. But no, it's still this somehow way of reinforcing kind of these human categories plus ultra. Right.
Well, right. I mean, they would say they privilege a divine perspective, but when God is a psychotic warlord, which is just a projection of human psychotic warlords, then that perspective is pretty nasty.
Yeah. This connects with Catherine's comment here. Ironically, the Bible is the first place I heard about people eating babies in Ezekiel, I think, during a famine that was a punishment from God. I guess I've got to go get some babies to eat to honor scripture. Gus writes, I love the kind of hope that Rebecca Solnit, who is outspokenly non-theistic, develops in Hope in the Dark and Paradise Built in Hell. Hope to her is the possibility of movement and the possibility that actions may create the opportunity for new action possibilities. Yeah, and that reminds me, it connects with Octavia Butler. One of her most known quotes is, I can't remember if it's change is God or God is change.
God is change.
God is change.
God is change.
And so the hope.
Shape change.
Yeah. And change, like, can be scary, but change can be good. So that's the idea, is like that change, but change is possible.
Mm-hmm.
Continue with the comments here. Gus writes, Kindred is also available in a graphic novel form. So good. Ooh. I did not know that.
I didn't know that either. Gus the librarian coming through again. So check that out.
Yep. Ed says, but Mark, I know you're going to say don't spiritual bypass into escapism. Well, yeah, I generally do say that. But to me, your comments before like are about reality, because you're recognizing that God is present here even now. And but these structures in the mind get in the way of it. So we should say no to them, or at least set them aside so that we can be attentive and present, because God is all in all. To me, that's leaning into ultimate reality rather than escapism. Although we're always it's amazing how those two things can be right next to each other, and you could slip into one very easily. So it's always a challenge. CK writes, the wrong kind of hope gets people killed. Yes. I mean, it's important to talk about hope in a way that's not naive or wishful thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, it's there.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of folks within various spiritual traditions, don't talk as much about hope as like fundamentalist Christianity does, which I think is an interesting thing to pay attention to, right? Because hope can just be very future oriented, right? It's the pie in the sky when you die kind of religion. Mm-hmm. And most spiritual teachings are really trying to discourage us from getting too lost in the future or caught up in the future. Right, because when we do that and we put too much energy into that, we're avoiding the present. And so that really the bulk of our energy and action, and this is where compassion arises, is are we willing to pay attention to what is really going on right now, internally and externally? Right? Are we really willing to become free right now? And so hope, in a sense, is not some sort of great vision, right? Every knee shall bow and every tongue shall wag that, you know, Jesus Christ is Lord kind of thing. Probably didn't say tongue wag in the Bible, right? I think it's
confess, proclaim.
Yeah. But that what hope is that if we actually let go of the future, right? This is the paradoxical thing. If we let go of the future and focus on compassion arising in the present, that the future will be better.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's
a very different orientation.
Even the thing like every knee shall bow, tongue confess Jesus Christ as Lord. I mean, it's not primarily a triumphalistic vision. It's this idea that, look, what we're doing now, we need to stay the course, because in the end, even though we're oppressed, we will be vindicated by a God who is present and shaping a better future. So therefore, we can let go of our fear of the future and live deeply into the way of Jesus now. If you take the ethical stuff out of that, which is what Christianity has done for 2,000 years, and rip it out, then it becomes this idea of we will subjugate the earth unto the lofty name of our Lord Jesus Christ, for all things shall bend towards his sovereign and indomitable will. Like, that's what it's become. And it's like, the idea of vindication because you're oppressed, living into this thing now and having anxiety about, like, is this worth doing, is gone. So it twists the entire meaning of what hope even could look like from a Christian eschatological view. Maria writes,
last comments on,
I don't have much hope unless Christianity can embrace being a servant.
Yeah, which is a lot like what you were just saying.
Yeah, and the, you know... Anybody who has any hope within Christianity at all is kind of foolish. So I'm recognizing that as I have a deep foolishness. Like, because I don't, when people walk away from this thing saying, I don't know if I want to do Christianity anymore, I'm like, okay, I understand why. Lindsay writes, Catherine Perrin, oh, how I love you. Some love from Lindsay to Catherine.
Yes. We love Catherine too.
Yeah. And I've always wondered with that emoji, that's a smiley face with a teardrop right here. Is that I'm laughing so hard I'm crying? Is that?
Like or no, like I'm sweating with love, maybe.
Lindsay sweats with love towards Catherine.
Yeah, I don't know.
Right. So we need a future to believe in. Otherwise, we can slip into disparity or despair and not work for a future. Yeah. And to me, well, I mean, I don't have to have like a lot of clarity about what that future looks like. So, I mean, this is.
Yeah, I'm not again. We could do a whole week on that one.
We should be writing notes because I think we've said, oh, we should do a week on this, week on that. I think we've said that three times now. And I think it's
change, future.
Hope, future, yeah, all kinds of stuff. Catherine writes, okay. I really appreciate the organizing idea that hoping for impossible seeming things like police and prison abolition in our lifetime is part of what can make them possible. And I feel like I can see that happening in our culture shift towards abolition being conceivable to many more people the past few years. It also feels complicated. Sometimes reaching for the unlikely, my friends and I will create a utopia, can lead to oppressive behavior, cults, etc.
Yep.
Yes. Well said.
Yeah, and this is imagination as prayer, right? The way you just described that. Exactly. Once we have the fearlessness to imagine certain things as possible, that begins to create their possibility. Not in some like magical, you know, new agey way, like I can, you know, create my reality or, you know, all the time, anything like that. There's a very interesting scientific theory about this called morphogenetic fields. You can look that up. Not going to describe what that is, but you know, basically this notion, right, that thought forms have an effect on reality. They're one of the things, one of the many, many things that have an effect on reality. And, you know, and this is why, you know, ideas, rhetoric, video casts, all this stuff is important because, yeah, it does begin to shape the future.
Yeah. Lindsay writes, thanks for this clarification. To me, it is the laughing subtlety emoji. Or subtly. So it's a subtle laugh. It's like
a subtle laugh. when one tear falls because you're laughing subtly.
Okay. James writes, realize eschatology amidst the fuckery. And that's the final word, I think, for today.
There we go. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll be back next week.
See you next week with to be determined what we'll talk about. But right. Thanks for all the comments. We'll see you next week.
Yeah. All right. Bye.